Good afternoon and welcome to this day three already of Crime Fest. I'm Maxim Jakubowski and I'd like to thank the festival organisers for inviting me as a guest this year for, I'm told, 20 years of disservice to crime fiction. And I didn't realise when they asked me to moderate the panel and they sent me this list and say, well, who do you want on the panel? And I didn't realise it was the list of all the people who couldn't fit on another panel. So, no, actually, they were people whose books I like and who I feel it's worth speaking to because obviously they're either unappreciated or not sufficiently known.
This is going swimmingly.
Indeed, that's the idea. So, these are Maxim's picks, as is said on programme, and there's no theme. It's just going to be a general conversation about their books, and we'll see what comes up. And if we get to blows, maybe you'll have a rather historic event. We have basically what I would term two quite established authors, and we have two fairly new authors who have come up over the last few years and are also very internet savvy, because obviously I think there's a whole new generation of writers, both here and the States, who are in fact coming up through the internet to a certain extent, and that's obviously Donna Moore and Declan Burke at the other end of the table. And of course, what Paul and Cara have in common is the fact that obviously they both have series, and in fact Paul has had, is now on his third series, he's a repeat offender, so to speak. Also, what they have in common, and we might or we might not talk about it, is the fact that their series are, not all Paul's in this case, but some of Paul's series and Cara's are set in countries where they, in other countries basically, I was going to say where they don't live, but of course Paul has lived and still lives in Greece. So basically I'll start in alphabetical order with Cara. Cara Black is an American writer, and her books are all set in Paris, where she has a female investigator called Aimé Leduc. Now, I was brought up in France and lived in France for 20 years, so I look at anything set in France with a very critical eye. And I'm happy to say that Cara gets it absolutely right. I mean, she's got the feeling of Paris. So far, there have been 9 novels in the series, and each one is called Murder in, and then in a specific area of Paris. All areas I know well, like the Marais, the Belleville, and more recently the Latin Quarter, where I misspent part of my own youth. And I'd like to start with Cara and ask her, basically, all your books so far have had this one character and they're all set in France. Why did you decide to set a series based in France? And you're not obviously a French writer.
No, I'm not French. I can't even tie my scarf the right way because we all know that's genetic, right? I mean, with French women. But, you know, I think I'm on the wrong panel because you said something about killers on this panel, natural-born killers. And I've got... I was in Paris this week, and I was at the GIGN, which is like the Delta Force, the SA equivalent of SAS for you. And I did get to fire a Glock, so I brought the shell casing. So, yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. How did I start to write about Paris and France? Well, my father was a Francophile. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. My uncle had gone to France after World War II to study art on the GI Bill, but he just drank a lot of red wine. And mealtimes at our family were about food and, you know, talking about art. And I went to actually a French Catholic school where we had nuns who wore wimples and the full outfit. And, you know, they had no peripheral vision is what I always say. So we got away with murder. But I first went to France in the early 70s as a student hitchhiking around. And we slept under the Pont Neuf. And I did get to meet the French author Romain Gary, who many know as being married to Jean Seberg. And when I met him, he invited me to a cafe on the left bank. And we walked into the cafe, and on the zinc counter was a cigar and an espresso waiting for Monsieur Gary because he went to this cafe every day. And as we walked in, the cafe man said to Monsieur Gary, "Well, what about her?" And Monsieur Gary said, "Well, she'll have the same." So I had my first cigar, my first espresso with this Prix Goncourt winning author, trying to lean on the counter, you know, and not cough. And it was quite an amazing experience. And maybe I thought, you know, this is the life of the writer. Maybe this is what I'll aspire to. I don't know.
And do you smoke cigars when you're writing?
Just Galois.
Our next panelist is Declan Burke. Now, Declan is an Irish journalist and author who's written two books, Eight Ball Boogie and The Big O, and I gather there are two more in the pipeline, a sequel to The Big O and another book called Gonzo Noir, which part of which, or all of it, has been posted online, I gather, recently.
Correct.
Now, and Declan, of course, also very active for his website, Crime Always Pays, which is mostly devoted to Irish crime fiction, but you have done a lot of detours outside. How did you come to crime? I mean, right now there is a renaissance, which I think none of us could question, of Irish crime fiction. How did you come to crime, and how do you explain this current explosion of quality Irish crime fiction?
Well, I personally came to crime fiction the way I think quite a lot of people do, which is via Enid Blyton. And the famous Five Mysteries. I'm not kidding when I say that. I mean, I would really have the Secret Seven and all these great, terrific stories. So from a very early age, you know, I was always thought that a story should have a mystery. And, you know, there should be something to be found out at the end. So they were the kind of books that I always liked. What kind of got me writing myself was encountering Raymond Chandler for the first time, reading rather than seeing the movies based on his books, but reading Raymond Chandler. In my early 20s, as a result of a film course I was doing in college, and I really just felt like it was coming home when I read the first paragraph of The Big Sleep, so that really had a profound effect. And then when I read Divorcing Jack by Colin Bateman, which was a comic novel set in Northern Ireland at the height of the Troubles, which is an incredibly brave thing to do at the time, because the last thing you did in Ireland was laugh at the Troubles. You could ignore it, you could get involved in it, but the last thing you did was, you know, laugh at it. And Bateman wrote a terrific, terrific novel, and it was very inspiring. So when the reason I set up the website, the blog, Crime Always Pays, was simply because the Big O, I co-published that with a small publisher in Ireland called Hagshead Press, which meant paying 50% of the cost. And reaping 50% of the rewards. And in order to have a kind of a platform to support the book, I decided to go online. I thought at the same time there was some terrific Irish writing being done that was saying some interesting things about the society we were living in and the changes that had happened to Ireland over the last 10 years. The Celtic Tiger, etc., had a profound effect on the country. And I thought, since, you know, the IRA ceasefire of 1994 and the second one of 96 and the death, or the murder, I should say, of Veronica Geeran, who was an investigative journalist in Ireland in 1996 by a criminal gang, there was a lot of books coming through that were dealing with this kind of subversive culture. And John Connolly, obviously, was something of a leading light for us, even though he set his novels in America. Ken Bruin, obviously, was doing some interesting work. Declan Hughes. I mean, I thought when I was starting up, I might get 15 or 20 Irish crime writers, past and present. The list is 120 at the moment, and growing, literally by the week. I discovered two more last week alone. So there is a lot of interesting things to be said about the country at the moment, and I think that the crime fiction novel is probably the best vehicle for saying them. In saying that, women's fiction slash chick lit, I don't know how people would prefer to hear it described, John Connolly's theory is that is why there is so much crime fiction coming out of Ireland today. It's because Ireland would have had a very literary tradition up until the last 10 or 15 years when people wrote in the higher art. But chick lit kind of kicked down the door, the likes of Marion Keyes following on from Maeve Binchy, and proved that there was an appetite in Ireland for commercial fiction, for genre fiction, for fiction that people could actually read and enjoy, believe it or not. So there was a lot of reasons why crime fiction in Ireland is taking off at the moment. It doesn't really matter why. There's such a terrific writers coming through. I think, you know, it's something to be celebrated, definitely.
Our third writer is obviously the most experienced of all the writers here in terms of number of books. You've published over 10 books and divided into three series. Your first series, the Quentin Dalrymple Pool, was set in a slightly futuristic Edinburgh. Where did that come from?
Yeah, well, I've never actually heard anyone refer to Enid Blyton on a crime writers panel. And I wish I could match that, but I came to crime writing via, in inverted commas, literary fiction. We love literary writers, us crime writers, don't we? And I wrote three, I guess, literary novels which were unpublished and probably unpublishable, although I'm picking over the bones of one of them at the moment. And then someone said to me, maybe my agent actually, who probably was at the end of a tether, said to me, why don't you write, you know, the stuff that you enjoy reading? And I actually have quite Catholic tastes with a small C in reading, but you know, crime fiction was definitely in there. So I decided I was going to write a crime novel. I was living in Greece at the time in the middle of nowhere, and I was quite cut off from back home, and I was kind of nostalgic for Edinburgh from where I am, even though I don't have much of a Scottish accent. But I was kind of feeling vulnerable about the fact that I didn't really know the place anymore. I'd been abroad for about 10 years. So the solution was to set things in the future so that if people complained about, you know, such a building not being there, I could just say, well, I got blown up in the drugs wars or something like that. And I think also there was a sort of hangover from my literary hankerings because, you know, I stuck bits of Plato in there. In fact, someone referred to my first novel, Body Politic, as Plato's Republic with a body count, which is almost as cool as Karen's Slug, but not quite. So, yeah, I mean, it was kind of that. I think we all kind of have quite meandering paths before we end up with writing what we do. And my path was probably more meandering than others.
And as the more experienced writer on the panel, obviously you've been through the editorial wars and you're already on to the third series. How come in 10 books are you already on to the third series? Obviously,
yeah,
the second one being set in Greece, of course.
Yeah, I'm kind of the opposite of Cara in that respect. I seem to be an unquiet soul. I haven't finished any of my previous series, I hasten to add. If anyone wants to, there's my editor, if anyone wants to make me an offer. my first series was five novels. My first five novels were all the same series in that futuristic Edinburgh setting. And I think the problem with we talked about SF before. I mean, the problem with, and my books are not SF at all, science fiction, but the problem with weird settings, futuristic settings, is that you throw in quite a lot of detail, and then after three, four, five books, you just kind of think, oh, you know, I can't be bothered inventing more of this stuff. You know, it's sort of getting a bit tedious. And with the Greek series, yeah, there were editorial wars issues with that. In fact, I'm happy to say that the three Greek novels have just been republished.
They've just been reissued, yeah.
My excellent new publishers, Mira. And I probably would have gone on with them if there hadn't been, publishing house issues. And in fact, I was so pissed off, excuse my terminology, but by the way I'd been treated by these nasty publishers, that the first of my current series, The Death List, is all about a crime writer who's also an investigator by kind of
Matt Wells,
yeah, not by choice really.
I gather Matt Wells, you told me, obviously is of course another version of Paul Johnston.
Well, I guess all of our characters, probably not all of our protagonists are, but one of the things in the first of those books, The Death List, is that quite a large number of people in the publishing industry get either murdered or have unpleasant things done to various parts of their anatomy. And I gather my old publishers are quite unimpressed by this. So, result. I think that's all I'm going to say on that one.
Okay. Our final panellist is Donna Moore, who's probably the newest of the writers here, but she's only published one book and several short stories, but I think it's a wonderful book and which I absolutely recommend to you, called Go to Helena Handbasket. Declan was talking about chick lit, and of course the nearest we have to chick lit, to chick lit with balls, so to speak, in the crime field are people like Janet Ivanovich and others. And I think Donna obviously has a potential to be, I wouldn't say a British, but a Scottish sort of Janet Ivanovich. Can you tell us about how you came to crime and why are you writing, so far, humorous crime?
Well, how I came to crime, like Deck, I was a big Enid Blyton fan. And then I moved on to Nancy Drew, and I always wanted to be Nancy Drew because I thought she was really cool. Her boyfriend was great. He was handsome and he was gorgeous. And her friends were just wonderful, loyal friends, and the car was brilliant. But I actually read one a couple of years ago and decided that Nancy was a bit of a whiner, and her boyfriend Ned was really, really pathetic. Her friends were just neurotic, but I still like the car. But I've always read crime fiction, moved through Agatha Christie to Raymond Chandler, as Dex said, and then onto the more noir and hard-boiled stuff. So I love reading noir and hard-boiled, and I'd love to be able to write it, but everything I write seems to come out like arsenic and old lace, so it just seemed natural to do the humorous thing. When I'm writing it, it actually doesn't seem funny, but I wanted to write a serious one, but just couldn't.
Okay. So, coming back to Paul, obviously, your second series, obviously, which we glossed over slightly, as you mentioned, obviously the first three books of the series have just been reissued in very nice matching cover paperbacks by Mira. This was set in Greece, and of course you have lived on and off in Greece for many, many years now. Did you find it easy to write something in your own home environment?
No, actually. I mean, I'd always wanted to write about Greece, and I have a broad knowledge of the culture and the language and everything else. Sometimes I find it harder actually than writing about Scotland, even far away from Scotland, and about London or wherever else. Partly, we were talking about this yesterday in the foreign crime panel, partly because you're aware always of, you know, sort of someone on your shoulder, which is the local. You know, am I right? You know, first of all, do I have any kind of right to be writing about this society and maybe making some fairly snide comments about it? Second, and even more worrying, if you're lucky, you get translated into the foreign language, which two of my books have been. You know, how the locals are going to respond? Also known as, are you going to get knifed? Because the first of my Greek novels, I was still living on a small island then, and the first novel was set on a small island, oddly enough. And I had to make the decision fairly early on: am I going to write this in the real place, or am I going to invent my own place? I guess actually having done that futuristic series where I kind of invented an alternative Edinburgh maybe gave me more confidence to invent an island. So I kind of turned the island around on its axis and invented another one, thinking this was very clever. And my 12-year-old daughter at the time read the book far too early, in fact, because it's very violent and nasty, and said, "Daddy, that's our island." So, you know, it can fail completely in that attempt to be subtle. So, I mean, I think that's one issue about writing foreign. I don't know what you think about that, Karen. I mean, you do have a quite large degree of vulnerability about what the locals think.
That's true, but I, you know, I write in San Francisco, so...
You're safe.
Yeah, I'm safe. But Paris is an exacting muse. If you're using a real place, I've got to get the streets right, and I have to bury Baudelaire in the proper cemetery, and... you know, but that I like that part of it too. I mean, I think that's fascinating, and I mean, just the other day I was there and I found this big iron pillar, and it had, you know, it had been painted. It was wet. It signed for wet paint, and I was taking all these photographs of it, and this old man was looking at it saying, "Pourquoi, Madame? Pourquoi?" But you know, when I get home, I need to have these things because I'm not on the island. You know, I'm in San Francisco in front of the computer in sweats. So.
You know, and I think also you can do that with cities. Because to some extent, everyone, you know, it's kind of the unreal city thing. I mean, you know, everyone has their own conceptions of cities. Plus, you know, you can get lost in cities, and people don't really mind if you mess around a bit. But a small place, a village, or even a town or an island. Well, you think of towns, think of Dexter's Oxford, you know, with this very, very, very high murder rate.
Oxford, the murder capital of England.
Yeah, absolutely, and these strange colleges which look exactly like, you know, they've got funny names. And so, I mean, you know, I think that's harder to do, but cities you can get lost in.
And interestingly enough, I mean, Donna Leon, who, as we all know, writes, obviously, about Commissario Brunetti in Venice, refuses, and she's being offered absolutely fortunes every year, she absolutely refuses for her books to ever come out in Italy. They're published everywhere in the world except in Italy.
That's interesting.
Did you have any reactions to the Greek translations of your book?
Yeah, actually, when I was saying this yesterday, I mean, the particularly the second one, which is the second book actually in the Greek series, The Last Red Death, which is about terrorism in Greece. So it's like a major and rather dodgy issue, which I think had been greatly misunderstood actually, both by the locals and by foreigners. And I was trying to sort of get to the bottom of where this terrorism came from. It's a lot about politics and so on. I was very apprehensive about that. And there was a huge amount of coverage in the press for a couple of weeks, and I thought, oh, this is wonderful. And they were being very nice. And then after that, you know, the shutters came down. It's, you know, it was like, okay, we'll let him in for a minute, this foreigner, this strange intruder, you know, and we'll talk nicely about his book, and then we're just going to forget it. You know, I don't know, have you had that, some experience in France? Or?
Yeah, I've had one book published in France, and another one, Murder in the Marais, the first book, will be translated end of this year or the next year. But, you know, it took 10 years to get my book translated, so I don't know what will happen with the coverage. So.
You'll see when you go through immigration control at the airport next time. Declan, I mean, your books have a sense of place because of Ireland, but I mean, how important is a sense of place? Because I get the feeling that in the two books I've read of yours, basically there is a very strong, much more American influence than the works of Paul or Cara.
Yeah, well, that's very deliberately me trying to kind of pay homage to the books and the novels that had inspired me to start writing, which were for the very great part American novels, and generally of the hard-boiled tradition. So the first one, Eight-Ball Boogie, was very deliberately an attempt to write in a kind of Chandlerian kind of style, but set it in a northwest town in Sligo. I thought it was, you know, it was just so crazy it might just work at the time. This will show you how naive I was. I had finished the first draft when I discovered Ken Bruin's novel, The Guards, which was set about 90 miles southwest in Galway, which kind of, you know, I said, well, that's that then. If Ken Bruin has already set a private eye in Ireland, and rural Ireland at that, then that set the seal on that. But at the same time, I thought, well, if there's room for one, maybe there's room for two. There wasn't, obviously. but, you know, that gave me enough legs to kind of finish the story and get it down. Funnily enough, when I was writing about Sligo, I'm from Sligo originally, but I live in south of Dublin now, I was finding it very difficult, as Paul was saying, to write about the place simply because I was too close to it. I'd been, you know, lived in, and grown up there. And a friend of mine said, well, why don't you just forget about the fact that it's Sligo and reinvent Sligo for yourself for whatever the book needs it to be, which I thought was terrific, and it worked a treat. So I redrafted the book, took the word Sligo out of the book, and it worked very well for me anyway, and then forgot to put the word Sligo back in the final draft to make it specific that this was the town. And there was this hoo-ha when the book did come out, well, a very minor hoo-ha, I should say, but a hoo-ha about why I was disguising Sligo, and what, was I ashamed of the place? Or, you're not pulling the wool over our eyes. We know that, you know, northwest of Galway is Sligo. So that was quite funny. But with the Big O then, I deliberately tried to set a book, in theory it was set in Dublin, but what I was trying to do was write a story that could have been set in any mid-sized city of the world, really. The idea being that these kind of stories, these kind of lovable losers is what I intended to create, with ambitions beyond their skills and you know, kind of bump around and fail gloriously as they do. These are the kind of stories that are universal, and they apply in Ireland these days just as they apply in England, in France, and in Australia, wherever it happens to be. So the sense of place wasn't... It was quite the reverse. It wasn't important to me for the second one. It was almost a senselessness of place was important to me for the second one, which some people liked, and I got hammered for it in other places because they were saying, you know, Ken Bruin can write a terrific Galway, Declan Hughes can write a terrific Dublin, and why can't Declan Burke do any kind of half-decent job on so, you know, you can't please them all. But, yeah, I mean, sense of place is very important, except when it's not.
Thank you, Samuel Beckett.
And Donna, of course, I mean, what draws me to your book and stories is not the sense of place, it's the wisecracks. I mean, this is obviously wisecracks, obviously it's Chandler, it's the PI novel. Obviously, you mentioned Enid Blyton and Nancy Drew, but surely there was some Chandler there.
Enid Blyton.
Yes, yeah, there was a bit of everything, really. I mean, it was a spoof of all the crime fiction genres. I love crime fiction, so I hope it comes across as affectionate. But it was actually taking all the clichés of crime fiction, whether they were from hard-boiled and noir crime fiction or the cosiest of cosies. So there's recipes, there's a cat that solves crimes, but there's also the PI, who just happens to be a female who loves shoes, and the Ramones. And she's not based on me, obviously. So it throws in all of those. So it brings in all of the books that I love. I don't think I managed to get any aliens in there, but I did try. But yes, it covers all of them. But I mean, Deck was saying about the sense of place. I mean, I needed a street called Sleazy Street and a pub called the Broken Bottle Covered in Blood. And despite the fact that we have a lot of pubs in Glasgow that could fit that description, there aren't actually any called that. So I just made it up, basically. So.
Novelists make something up.
Yeah.
Shock.
Stop the presses. And might Helena return in another book?
Well, I've left the ending sort of open, and people have said to me, what did that mean? But I'd like to actually bring her back. I think maybe a European one would be quite good, and that would give me a chance to go and meet Cara in Paris.
There you go. Go shoe shopping.
But the interesting thing is, you published your book with a small American press. The book has never come out in England. I mean, very few. Some copies have been distributed. What happened? Couldn't you get a British publisher for it?
Actually, the whole way that it happened was really peculiar in that I'm on an internet mailing list, and we were talking about clichés in crime fiction, and everybody was saying, oh, I hate it when the heroine goes down into the basement at midnight without a gun or a torch. I hate the alcoholic ex-cop who's been divorced 8 times, etc. And I just basically stole all their ideas and put them into a book. And somebody who was the commissioning editor of a small press, Point Blank Press, happened to see it, and he wrote me an email saying, if you would consider expanding that, we'd consider publishing it. And I just fired him off an email saying, don't be so stupid. But then I thought, well, actually, I'll give it a try. So I never tried to get it published with a UK publisher, but I think it's just a little bit out there, and I don't think anyone would touch it.
And Declan, you mentioned, obviously, in terms of, obviously, the editorial adventure, so to speak, that you actually partly published, was it 8-Ball Boogie or
The Big O? The second one.
The Big O,
yeah.
So who did 8-Ball Boogie? Was it a small Irish publisher?
That was the Lillipop Press, which is a small literary imprint in Ireland, yeah.
So that basically your only contact with what I would term big-time publishing is when The Big O was taken on by one of the American houses.
It was picked up by Harcourt after we... We only published 800 copies in Ireland, and the idea being that we both liked the story. Marcia Swan, who is Hag's Head Press, decided to go ahead and publish 800 copies with the hope that it would be picked up by a bigger publisher and be brought to a wider audience. It was just the 100 things that could possibly go wrong with your book occurred almost immediately, that my editor lost her job in a merger between Harcourt and Houghton Mifflin. The book became an orphan, etc., etc. So it almost feels terrific that it has gone on that journey. It's almost as if it's been a lightning rod for all the bad luck I could possibly ever have in my career. I'm very, very proud and was quite proud that not just I, but my wife and I at the time took that kind of leap of faith as a family, because it wasn't a huge amount of money to get it published, but it was still mortgage money that we were spending on getting this book out there. And happily enough, the reviews were terrific. We're very happy about that. And it was nice to kind of have the courage of your own convictions and see them, you know, kind of fulfilled, especially when Harcourt came in. Stacia Decker was the editor at the time there, and she was working with a lot of writers that I really admired, like Alan Guthrie and Ray Banks and James Salas, and that kind of gave a certain vindication as well. But the nicest thing about it was that by virtue of it being promoted on Crime Always Pays, it put me in contact with a huge, huge range of people in the industry, writers for the most part, which is terrific, because writing is a solitary business. You know, you sit in the room at the desk at your, and it's really nice to use the internet to meet people and to be in touch. So, you know, it has brought an awful lot. I mean, the Big O is the reason I'm sitting here today on a panel with some excellent writers that some of them I really admire. And, you know, I've got to meet terrific people this weekend. It was the same last year at BoucherCon last year in America. That was a terrific experience. So, you know, it's a small thing, but it's mine own type of thing. And I'm delighted. If it was the only book that was ever published of mine, I would be quite proud of the fact that it was, you know, that I co-paid to have it published rather than be, you know, secretly ashamed of the fact, you know.
And what about the experiment of putting your new novel, Gonzo Noir, out on the internet before it even goes out to publishers?
Well, again, that's something. I'm fascinated by the power of the internet and what it can do. And I think publishing and the internet are slightly at loggerheads at the moment. Individual writers and companies can use it to promote, but I don't think its power is being fully utilized, well, anywhere near utilized, by publishing companies. To promote their authors and to promote the business of writing as it is. But I just liked the idea, as I said, when I was blogging about it, when I was started to put it up on the web, the entire novel, that I was doing it because I can. It was almost that, you know, people climb mountains because they're there, and, you know, why not put a novel up on the internet for free? If people want to read it, they can. The problem with the internet is that it's just, you know, as you're scrolling down and down and you have the glare from the screen, it's just not a particularly good format upon which to read an entire novel, short story certainly. But I just wanted to do it as an experiment and see what the reactions would be. And some of the reactions were very positive, and hence it's this month it's going out to, in a more conventional manuscript form, it's going out to publishers for its traditional mass rejection, as I said yesterday. And I'll then publish it through Lulu just in time for the Christmas rush.
Talking about the internet, and of course, I mean, I know that obviously Declan is not just a veteran and expert, but it goes in the family because obviously Declan's daughter has been blogging since her first week. And Donna, Cara, Paul, do you have websites?
Yeah.
And what do you try and do on your websites?
Very little. Get someone else to update it every time a book comes out, which actually I've failed abysmally to do with these reprints. I admire Declan and Donna for using the internet in the way they do, and I'm a bit frightened of it. I guess I'm a bit of a Luddite at heart. For instance, blogging, which Declan's certainly a master at, I don't know, do you blog now?
Well, sometimes.
There are so many blogs out there, and it's all very well chatting with your mates at a crime fest or whatever else about, you know, the state of publishing or the new X book or whatever else, but, you know, there's possibly a limit to how many opinions are worth putting out on air, you know, and I just don't feel attracted by that. But as I say, I probably am a bit of a Luddite.
I should probably say that the blogging that I do isn't the traditional kind of blogging where, as Paul says, an author has, you know, 221 opinions and manages to get them all crammed into one post. The blog is more to do with promoting mostly Irish crime fiction. So nine posts out of 10 will be to do with, you know, Brian McGilloway has a new book coming out, or X amount of Irish authors are appearing at Harrogate. And, you know, it's there to promote the Irish crime writing as a whole. And on the left-hand side is my little book, you know, kind of screaming for attention. And every now and again, I will have a little bit of fun with it and do a post on, you know, who is the sexiest Irish crime writer, for example.
Who won that?
Pardon?
Who won that?
It's still ongoing. Adrian McKinty is cheating his way into the lead as we speak. But, you know, it's not the kind of traditional blog, as Paul says. I would agree with Paul that I don't think I have that many opinions worth publishing, and if I did, I'd keep them and put them in a book and try and make a few quid out of them.
Right.
But, you know, as I say, it's there more to promote other people, as well as myself, of course. So it's not that traditional kind of blog.
I've actually become more afraid of the internet since my dad rang me up and said, I Googled you last week, and that sort of put me off, really.
Well, if you Google me, I'm a pro Zimbabwe tennis pro who's probably at Roland Garros next week. You know, that's the other Cara Black, Rhodesian, I think. And so I say, well, that's my other, you know, job. Mm-hmm. But I have a website because I think we all need them. And my husband is my webmaster,
but
so he's cheap.
Apart from publishing your books, I mean, do you interact with readers and fans through your website?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I do. I have a little bit of a blog, and when you know, when I go home, I'll do my pictures of Paris, my trip to Paris, and put that on there, or Amy's Paris, or new shoe shops I've discovered, and that kind of thing, or to the shooting range. But, yeah, I do go to blogs. I go to Murderati, which is Zoe's blog, and there are some very well-known ones that I often go to. But I stop and visit, and I leave. I don't keep my blog up as faithfully as I should to get all these hits, which we're supposed to be doing, is getting all these hits. I'm not promoting that.
I very foolishly, when I first set my, when someone else set my website up for me about 7 or 8 years ago, I guess. That long? Anyway, whatever. I very foolishly said, if you get in touch with me, I solemnly promise I will answer every email I get, which is fine for the first few booths. We've frankly hardly anyone ever sent an email. But then one book, The Death List, which came out a couple of years ago, seemed to prompt an amazing number of emails. And I suddenly found myself going, oh my God, I hope there aren't any more emails, because I was spending an hour a day answering these things. And possibly being rather too fastidious and not just having a standard answer. Because I'm sure I would screw that up and say dear dot dot dot.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's again, it's fascinating. You get fascinating insights into what you're doing. You sometimes get fantastic levels of abuse as well. How dare you write such an? I mean, I had one email saying that. You know, how could you write such a? Compared with your previous books, this is just absolutely rubbish. Okay.
And why is the accent over here? And you've got this misspelling and this French word. You know, five le instead of la. And so. Yeah. But you know, if they're right, they're right, and you have to answer. You know, and so you're right. And, you know.
I don't think it was me who said the one about the accent, but
are you sure?
I'm very particular about the French words and books. But coming back to the internet, I mean, I found, and Donna, you're very much, you've been at the centre of it. I mean, there is a whole new generation of writers who are not just obviously blogging or, I don't know if the word is chatting, but at least communicating through the internet and the various websites, but more and more over the last few years, and because I edit an annual anthology of the best British crime stories, over the last few years I'm working on volume 7 right now, and already I've already found 5 stories which only appeared in internet magazines, and there are more and more crime magazines on the internet, purely because there are so few outlets for short crime fiction out there in print. We have virtually none in England and barely 2 or 3 in America. I mean, that's what I found fascinating. And people like you, people like Alan Guthrie, Ray Banks, Tony Black and others have all come up through the internet, which is a different way for authors to come up.
And it's also, I mean, short stories, the ones that I write, say for the internet or for anthologies, they tend to be slightly different from the things that I normally write, and I wouldn't point my mum in their direction. I mean, I think it's a great way of getting your name out there and getting known and actually doing something that's slightly different. I mean, I'm primarily a reader, and so I'm on a lot of mailing lists for readers, and we discuss crime fiction, talk about books we like, and obviously we get ideas for, you know, for new authors that we might like. And the blogs that I tend to visit most are those that are done by readers. Karen Meek's Eurocrime, for example, which has great reviews on it, and she keeps a really good blog. Maxine's Patrona, Norm's Crime Scraps, etc. So I don't often visit authors' blogs unless they're people I know, like Deck, but that's mainly because I want to see pictures of Lily. So I tend to sort of dip in and out and have conversations with people rather than, you know, sort of do a promotional thing. Mm-hmm. But for short stories, I love short stories that you read on the internet. Mm-hmm. And it does lead me to new authors, which is, for me, the main thing.
No, I mean, I've been amazed by the fact there are more and more stories there, and stories worth publishing. I mean, it reminds me of sort of 30 years back when I was beginning in the science fiction field. And at the time, there were so many magazines, and that's where lots of authors started with short stories and then graduated to novels. But now, in the crime area, there are so few outlets for short stories, and I feel that the short story is such a good training ground for coming up for writing novels. You've never written many short stories, have you,
Paul? I was just going to offer you one, actually.
Oh.
actually, yeah, I mean, the first one I ever wrote, you did publish yeah. one of those.
Don't think I've ever seen any since.
No, I don't think you haven't. Oddly enough, neither have I. I find short stories really hard to write. I don't know what other people feel about this, but I do view myself as a novelist, actually, not a general fiction writer. I mean, I did write a short story a few weeks ago, actually. Just sort of sat down as it came, but... One of the problems, I was going to mention this, raise this earlier, actually. I mean, one of the problems, I think, with crime short stories is that there's a very large danger of the gimmick. I think a lot of noir-y ones can avoid that, although not always. I think you can get away with gimmicks if they're well set up in a novel and, you know, sort of fitted in with everything else. In a short story, the gimmick tends to stick out a lot. And I don't like reading stories like that. So, you know, I'm don't view myself as being much of a crime short story.
I think you've been reading the wrong short stories.
That may well be right. I do prefer reading crime novels to short stories, actually. So there, have a go.
No, I would totally agree with that. I tend to read particularly crime fiction for character more than anything else. And I think, you know, the short story simply isn't long enough form to allow, you know, a writer develop a character to its fullest extent. But just to go back to the point you're making about short stories, you know, and internet outlets, a classic example is an Irish writer called Stuart Neville, who published a short mm-hmm. story to the web.
Just now coming up with his first novel.
It was turned, yeah, an agent picked up on it, and it's coming out, I think it's next month, with terrific blurbs from John Connolly, James Ellroy, and Ken Bruin. And I've read it; it's a terrific novel.
The 13.
The 12.
The 12.
I was increasing
the size of it.
Not lucky enough. Eh?
But I think you will start seeing more of that. There's a number of companies that have set up. It's almost like they're using the internet now for their slush funds. Or slush piles, excuse me, perhaps slush funds too.
What does that mean?
Maybe combine the two. And I think you're going to see an awful lot more of that, Joe.
I agree. I do. I definitely feel it. It is one of the trends in the way that sort of writing and publishing are beginning to change, whether we like it or not.
There is this feeling that, you know, that internet publishing could replace. Sorry about those publishers. I guess it won't happen fully, but I mean, you know, it could cut out, if you like, the middleman between the writer and the reader.
I mean, the worst case scenario, probably for publishers, but possibly also for writers, is that, you know, Amazon becomes almost the single monopoly in that, you know, a writer can upload his or her novel to Kindle and to Amazon, have a contract with them, cut out agents, cut out publishers, cut out, you know, the paper aspect of publishing. And then Amazon get to pay the writer whatever the hell they want per download, which probably won't be an awful lot, you know. But that in theory, that could be done right now. The technology is there. Yeah. So, you know, that's only developed in the last 3 or 4 years. Crikey, only knows what it's going to be.
At a very, very awkward juncture, I feel.
Yeah.
Before we open it up to the audience, who I'm sure have fascinating questions, I'd like to ask one final question to all four panelists, since it's a fairly standard question. What is next, Paul?
The next book that will be out is the third in the Matt Wells series, which is a complete kind of reinvention of the character, I think, because it starts off with him suffering from amnesia. Yes, I have read The Bourne Ultimatum or whatever.
Are you sure?
yes, I have, and I've done it differently. And he's also in the States. The book's completely set in the States, so it's kind of ring every change that you possibly can. So that's that. And in my spare time, I'm writing a novel about Gallipoli, the Gallipoli campaign, not a crime novel, although Gallipoli was a crime.
Carla?
Well, Murder in the Latin Quarter came out this March. It's the ninth in the Amy Leduc investigations, and it was set against September 1997, right after Princess Diana's car crash, you know, in Paris, 2 weeks afterwards. So in the next book, Murder in the Palais Royal, which comes out next March, we've gone ahead 1 month in October 1997, and Amy she works on the Rue du Louvre, so it's all set in the first arrondissement of Paris. A murder does happen in the Palais Royal, and that's next.
Donna?
Well, for me, it's actually a book which is had its genesis in a short story that I wrote featuring two elderly ex-hookers. And I liked the characters when I wrote about them in the short story, so it's a book called Old Dogs, which these elderly ex-hookers carry out a heist on a museum in Glasgow. To steal two gold and jewel encrusted old dogs. And unfortunately, there are other people after these dogs, including a couple of chavs, or Neds as we call them in Glasgow, a young Tibetan monk from the Scottish Islands. And there's an Australian hitman after the two old ladies. It's finished. It's currently with my agent, but whether it'll ever see the light of day, I don't know. But I had great fun writing it.
Declan, I mean, I know that you're working on a book. Is it of interviews with Irish crime writers?
That's what.
But what's coming up on the fiction side?
For myself, I mentioned A Gonzo Noir, or Bad for Good. A Gonzo Noir is his full title. Is going out this month to publishers. It's actually a story I'd written 4 or 5 years ago about a psychopathic hospital porter who decides he wants to blow up the hospital where he works to kind of let society know that. Society is always undone from within. It's very rarely civilization is undone from without, and it sat sat in a drawer for 4 or 5 years. And one morning not so long ago, I was looking out the window into the back garden. I just got an idea that Carlson, who is the hospital porter, had turned up in the back garden that morning to ask me why he was still in a state of limbo, why he was still waiting to be published, and could I please crack on and do whatever it took to get him published, because this half-life was doing nobody any favours. So the book then, it becomes a kind of I hate to use the word metafiction, but I think that's the official term for it, a dialogue between me and him as we both write the story and make him a nicer psychopath so that the public are more likely to want to see him published.
Well, I think all four books that I'm greatly looking forward to, and I think you will too. Questions from the audience for anybody on the panel? Peter, over there.
Yeah, well, for Cara, one of your fellow panelists in Baltimore, VoucherCon, Michael Tinellan, talked about the advantage of being an outsider writing in a country not his or her own. Do you see that, and if so, what sorts of advantages does your respect?
The advantages of being an outsider? Yeah, I do feel like an outsider in France. I am an outsider. And I reread a lot of the Inspector Maigret, the Georges Simenon novels, which I love, you know, and you know, he was Belgian, and he had moved to Paris when he was, I think, in his early 20s. And that gave me hope, because I think with you, and, you know, maybe you as well, I mean, when you come in as an outsider, you're noticing things that are different, you know. I can notice the differences in the weather, because in San Francisco, where I come from, we have one season, which is fog. So in Paris, there's, you know, four seasons, which is something I notice. But I think there's something that I tune into or my eye catches that's different, and I hope that stands out to me and I write it down. I hope that answers your question. But I'm not French, you know, and I have a terrible accent. My biggest thrill is when someone comes up to me on the street corner in Paris and asks directions. And, you know, and I'm like, okay. I do the shrug and the poof, you know. And then the minute I open my mouth to tell them where to go, they go, oh, you're Canadian, you know, which I really love to be called a Canadian instead of American. But it's kind of fun. In a way, I'm sort of feeling like I'm French or hoping to pass for French, but I'm not. So.
Yeah, I think that's right, actually. I mean, I do feel that as well. I mean, that book I read about terrorism in Greece, I don't think a Greek could have written, because you know they can't get out of the mindset, particularly the political mindset that they've grown up in. Whereas I just don't have that, you know, for better or worse. So I mean, I think it can definitely be an advantage, even if it might be tricky as well.
Right. I had to go talk to some people in the Ministry of Culture to ask for a tour in the Palais Royal, and my French friend kept saying, "Well, we have to make an appointment. We have to do this 3 weeks in advance. We have to write a letter." And I said, "Well, why don't we just go ask?" And, you know, because I'm brash and an American, you know, I got through.
Another question? Don't be shy, you're one there.
Paula, if you try a blog, you don't have to answer any emails, because you can just make them all put their comments online, and then ignore them.
That's true, but slightly cynical. Yeah,
would you prefer to be more cynical, Paul? Would that be more? We can arrange it.
Okay. I guess that's true. Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of major problem somehow that, you know, having contact with readers.
Do you still answer your emails?
Yeah.
Question there.
Most of you seem pretty knowledgeable about the internet. How do you feel about Google quite happily copying work and sort of not really wanting to do anything about copyright?
Well, on principle, obviously against, but on the other hand, free access to a lot of, I don't think it would necessarily apply to our books, but you know, if you can get free access, or you know, more or less free access to great works of literature, whether it would be free access was another story. But you know, I think that is a good thing. Yeah, I mean, copyright definitely should be respected. I think all authors would say that. Although, I mean, obviously there are issues with the internet there, aren't there? You know, you're not protected so much, are you, just by the nature of the thing.
And even the, you know, the Amazon look in this book. I mean, there are ways of reading the whole book through that. So,
I think the whole problem is books are being digitized not only by Google but by a number of organizations, and obviously right now they're actually saying that they will respect copyright, but once the books are digitized, who's going to control it? I mean, if Google are bought by News International or Rupert Murdoch or anybody else in 10 years or in 2 years, then whatever the current Google directors are saying doesn't have any value, and basically all the books which have been digitized will be out there and available. In theory, they can sell them and they can dictate what royalty rate the authors will get, and what the authors will get will be the smallest possible sort of percentage, even smaller than what they're getting at present from publishers. So I think it is a very important issue, but it's one that it's very difficult to do anything about right now. I mean, obviously, all the publishers, writers' organisations are all fighting it, but the sheer cost of going legal on this right now, and people are going legal, obviously, the Google settlement hasn't been agreed, and there are lots of objections, but I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen, and it is, in the long run, it is very worrying for basically the creators.
But the reality is you're going to have to plan for a new world, and the question is how will you plan for this new world? And Declan mentioned the idea of Kindle. How is this going to affect you as a writer? Is this going to change your interest in writing, or are you going to have to go along with whatever the new systems are if you're going to continue to write?
I'm answering for myself. I mean, a writer is always a writer. A writer will always write, but it would be nice to make a living out of it.
Right.
And basically, all these changes which are on the horizon now are going to make it more and more difficult for authors to make a living from their writing. And we'll be going back more and more, unless obviously you're not an author, but what they now call a brand, and very few of us will ever be brands, we'll become amateur writers, writing in our spare time between our full-time jobs.
Is that necessarily a bad thing? I don't know. I mean, I have been lucky enough to be full-time for about 10 years, but I sometimes wonder, actually, if it's perhaps potentially, you know, you can focus on your own writing too much. Maybe it's a good thing to have another job. I don't know what anyone else thinks.
My books have been put on Kindle, which I just found out, but I really don't know. I'm just going to, you know, I just want to write the book and see what happens. I don't think we can predict the future. It's a new world. You know, my husband owned a bookstore in San Francisco, independent bookstore, until November, when he couldn't afford the rent. So, I mean, I'm quite sad about the independent bookstores leaving us and about your bookstore in London, and I think that's something that, you know, that's the human touch. I mean, I go into an independent bookstore and I can touch the books, I can smell them, and the bookseller will say, oh, you might like this, or maybe that's not up your alley. I want the human there, which I think we're all losing with all the machines that we have to keep charged all the time.
But it's not only to the internet now. I've got a TomTom sat nav, which I update every now and again. And last month, they're now offering me books to download from sat nav.
No. Geography books.
Once a book has been digitized, it can be downloaded to anything. I mean,
well, I presume
there are already books being downloaded to mobile phones.
Only iPhone you can get now.
Yeah, indeed.
And I presume the reason for the download to GPS is that you can listen to it in the car the way you do with, you know, with CDs of a novel, or, you know, so that's actually quite a great idea. The issue, and this gentleman here, he asked and answered the same question when he said, how are you going to deal with, are you going to adapt to this brave new world, whatever it happens to be. And as Max said, that, you know, writers are going to write. you know, people are not going to stop writing stories and wanting to write and want to read stories for that matter simply because the means of delivering these stories has changed. You know, people didn't stop wanting to read stories when Gutenberg invented his press, or wanted to read stories in a different way because Gutenberg invented his press. It is going to be a very dangerous world, I think, for the next 4 or 5 years. But I was thinking it was The Guardian had a piece last week, just to pick up what Paul was saying about the idea of the gifted amateur returning. And it said, you know, the likes of T.S. Eliot and Charles Dickens, these people were all writing in their spare time. You know, these were not full-time professionals who were touring the world to promote their books. And I would say, you know, the publishing industry is very much, in terms of writers, is very much a pyramid scenario. And you know, I would say that the bottom two-thirds, at least, are all, you know, part-time. They're like me, they're getting up at 5:30 in the morning to work, you know, write for an hour and a half before the day actually starts. And I don't know, you know, this idea of not being, that Google is going to rip off my copyright and I'm not going to get paid to, I'm not getting paid anyway, you know. what this thing with Google might mean is that I won't have to pay to get my books published the next time, you know. So you never know, it might be a good thing for the people on the bottom of the pile of the pyramid.
I think we have time for one more question there, please. I think it's a chicken and egg situation. It's a question of what comes first. I spent a few decades as a publisher. Then, after I left publishing, I opened a bookshop, an independent bookshop, which lasted nearly 21 years until I decided that it wasn't going to get any better, and we decided to close it. We didn't go bankrupt, we just closed it, because obviously the future is so difficult. And throughout those years, I've also been a writer and a reviewer. Basically, I applaud any initiative that gets people to read more books, or people to get books cheaper, although on the other hand, obviously books are being discounted in huge quantities by the chains and the supermarkets who are selling books at a loss. I mean, not if it's a thriller, but obviously I don't think it's a book that we would recognize as one of ours. The new Dan Brown comes out in September. The print run in America is going to be 6 million copies. The UK print run is set at 2 million copies. Every supermarket and every chain in England is already offering it at under 50% discount. So that nobody is going to make any money out of that. Certainly not they're selling it as a loss leader because they're basically going for...
Dan Brown will.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, one of the few cases where the author will actually make any money.
But obviously, but that's a brand now. And, I mean, as Declan says, I mean, the next 4 or 5 years are going to be absolutely vital and could see a major change in, shall we say, the order of things between writers, publishers, and retailers and the internet. And I wouldn't know what to predict. And I've been in every link on the chain, and still am. I think we still have time. There was one more question over there, Bez. That was a half question. The final question.
I've got family.
How do you juggle your time? Are you very strict on when you write? Or do you just lock yourself in a room for a week? Or how do you do it?
Well, definitely gets up at 5:30.
For me, I work condensed hours, so I work full-time 4 days a week, and then I have Fridays off. Well, to write. Friday's not a day's holiday, it's a day to write. So I do a lot of writing on a Friday. But I write any time that I can, basically. And if I'm not writing, then I'm thinking about it while I'm being a pensions consultant. I'm thinking how to murder the person in front of me.
And I get up early and I write. Excuse me. I used to get up like you at 5 o'clock because then I'd have 2 hours before my husband and son got up. But I do get to stay home now and write. And I find that sometimes I get more done. Like, I would have gotten more done if I'd worked in that, you know, 5 to 7 hour, because it's very concentrated, very special time. But I do, I work early in the morning, and then if I don't check email or read blogs, which is the death knell, and then I've been getting this big surge later in the afternoon because my son started going to lacrosse practice, so I used to have this 2 or 3 hour. So I started to get this great wind with copious cups of coffee, you know, but I feel it's been going around, like Donna says, in my mind all day, you know, while I'm doing other things. So, but, you know, it's just, it's really all, you can't really get away from it, I think. Or do you want to get away from it?
Well, the one good thing about being full-time is that you don't have to get up at 5:30. I mean, that's probably why, because obviously being full-time, you do make sacrifices in terms of particularly financial. But being able to control your own hours is definitely a big thing. I mean, I could ever go back to doing anything else, frankly.
And Declan, you work as a journalist, I think.
Yeah, freelance
so
journalist.
So how do you juggle, obviously, the writing for the job and the writing for you, so to speak?
At this stage, you know, the writing is not the priority, unfortunately. I mean, it's the priority in my head and in my heart, but, I mean, it cannot be, in practical terms, the priority. The job comes first. The mortgage needs to be paid, particularly in these straitened times. But you know, if you want to get written badly enough, and if you want to put one word in front of another, it's not going to write itself, and you'll just carve out. Ideally, you're writing 7 days a week, and if that's a half an hour each day, or at least 6 days a week, that's you know, I liken writing to training for the Olympics. You're never going to win an Olympic gold, you know, training twice a week. So I'd try to do, you know, something, half an hour and a half every day. It could be 5:30 in the morning, it could be 11:30 at night. It doesn't always happen. It just, you know, circumstances overtakes you. But, you know, all you can do is keep on, you know, and try and gouge out that hour and a half every day. And at some point, you hope something will come together and make sense at the end of it.
Well, we've covered a lot of subjects in 1 hour, and I think on all of them we could have continued for quite a long time. But time is up, and we have Michael Connolly in here in half an hour. I'd like to thank Declan Burke, Donna Moore, Cara Black and Paul Johnston for being on the panel, and thank you for your questions. And we have a prize for the best question, and I think the first question on the internet started us going. So for the lady there, we have a bag, which I'll give you on the way out. Thank you very much, and thank you for my panelists.